My name is Joe Hine and welcome to Inflection Points, our podcast about how leaders found a new path to growth. And today we spoke with Ian Anderson, founder and chairman of Cicero. You'll love this one because we discuss how Ian founded Cicero and why he took on investment, the use of M&A, and how he used it to grow his business, and ultimately why he sold his business. And we deep dive into political life and why Ian fears question time. From SI Partners, this is Inflection Points. My guest today is Ian Anderson, founder and executive chairman of Cicero. Cicero works with the C-suite to advise on communication strategy, global political risk, and public policy. Ian was one of the founders of the agency. It successfully grew through organically and through acquisition before selling to Havas's H Advisory Global Strategic Network. But chairing Cicero is only Ian's day job. He works with a number of boards, including St. Andrews University and Innovate Finance. He was chair of Stonewall and for a time LGBT business champion to Boris Johnson's government. He regularly contributes to national and international media, including Sky News and the BBC, and is a panelist on Question Time. After years as a paid-up member of the Conservative Party, he's just authored a review of business relations on behalf of Keir Starmer and the Labour Party. Phew. Ian, welcome to Inflection Points.
Good to be with you, Joe.
Ian, politics has come to define your entire life, but what inspired you to first follow this path?
So I'm 16. I'm sitting at home. I think my parents had gone out. It's a Friday night. And on comes this movie, All the President's Men. And that was it. And if anyone, you know, out there watching this, listening to this, has seen the movie, you'll know it's about the Watergate era. It's about the fall of Nixon. It's about two investigative journalists, both of whom are still alive, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, and they bring down a presidency. And the story was so intriguing, so captivating. I've watched the movie now over 30 times, so I can completely geek out on it. But I said, no, that's it. I want to be around politics. I want to be around news. I want to be around communicating ideas. And before I even got to university, that was the inspiration that sent me on a particular journey. At any time, Joe, that I get just a little bit tired, jaded, and the roller coaster of life that I think, you know, we all have sometimes, I watch that movie again and it just gives me another little spur. So yeah, one film.
So it's become a bit of an obsession.
A complete obsession. You know, I'm afraid I could probably recite parts of the movie too, but we probably don't have long enough to do that today. But yeah, it's, you know, I think so many of the values of that film about getting to the truth, about cutting through to find the real story. I think about, you know, to some extent, trust in public life. I mean, my goodness, that's a theme that we're all over these days as well. And all of that before a digital era. Yeah, no, it's an amazing movie.
And have you been to the hotel, the Watergate Hotel?
So, yeah, to carry on the geek theme, on the 17th of June, 2022, it's like 50 years to the day after the Watergate burglars broke in to the building, me and my other half had a very enjoyable night geeking out overnight in the Watergate Hotel. We even had fish and chips. And the burglars apparently ate, they were a bit posher, perhaps. They had lobster and fries the night before they broke in. Apparently they drank far too much, which is maybe one of the reasons why they got caught.
So tell us a bit about Cicero. What is it that you do and who do you do it for?
So we founded the business in the early part of the noughties. And we started as a generalist shop, right? You know, we opened the door, we raised finance, angel capital, created an enterprise investment scheme. And the offer was to help people with corporate communications, to help people with their political and regulatory dialogue. And we found after a while that actually focusing in on a particular market sector would be quite an unusual thing to do. So for the first half of the business, we focused very much on the city. Mm-hmm. So very much on the banks, asset managers, insurers, long-term investors. And as the business grew in the second half of our journey as an independent, we actually started working, doing those things with other parts of the economy. So tech, infrastructure, energy. So now that we're part of Havas, it's still very much that journey, helping people with campaigning around governments, around regulators, and around media where there is a high intensity issue. You need me when you're looking for the long term.
Yep.
You need Cicero when you're looking for an issue that might emerge or an immediate issue.
Yeah. Not many agencies take on investment as part of their the beginning of their journey. What sort of was the thinking behind that, and how did that sort of play out as you were you know, growing the business?
So whilst I worked for banks as clients, I didn't want to work for the bank in my own business. I'd seen my own father build a business, and maybe that's where the entrepreneurial bug was there, Joe. And he built his business around the oil and gas sector. And when the oil price fell off a cliff in the mid-1980s, he suddenly didn't have a business, right? And that really impacted me. And I thought, well, actually, can we do this by raising investment? I'd been part, when I was a journalist, of the launch of a business that became Incisive Media. Again, some people may know that business listening to this podcast. They did exactly the same thing. They raised angel capital. So we raised angel capital from ourselves, friends, family, one or two city types, yes. What that meant was that when we hit sticky patches, I mean, probably the stickiest patch we hit in the trajectory of our business was the global financial crisis at the end of the noughties. As I said earlier, we're very, very focused on financial services, very focused on the city, and all that stuff was blowing up. If we'd raised cash, if we'd raised debt, we might not have still been here. The equity allowed us to continue, and actually the equity and the patience of our investors allowed us to kind of grow in the way we did after.
Fantastic. And so you talked about 2008. It must have been a big inflection point for the business. How did it feel to be in the middle of that crisis? And, you know, like all your clients are within that financial services sector.
So I think for any business person, you have moments where you think, I don't know if we're going to be able to keep the show on the road. And in 07, I remember when Northern Rock and some of those other businesses were blowing up. And I remember saying to friends and family going into the festive period in 07, this is going to be really, really tough. And people say, no, Ian, don't, what are you talking about? It's fine. It's all fine. It's just a little localized difficulty. And I said, I don't know. I think this subprime thing could be harder than you think. And so, of course, it proved in 08. And in the final quarter in 08, we got the thing that I think you sometimes do get when you know, you're running a business. Clients turn around and say, it's not you, it's the market. And we, in the space of about 2 months, lost about 40% of our client base.
Wow.
And my partner, Mark, we went away for a very long planned holiday in Japan in the early part of 09. We thought, should we go? Oh, well, actually, there's nothing I can do about a global financial crisis. Let's just go and explore a brand new country. And when we were there, quantitative easing, something that we're all still living with, kicked in, right? Globally, the Americans did it. The Japanese did it. The British did it. The Europeans did it. And suddenly markets bounced by about 10%. That was quickly followed by Gordon Brown as Prime Minister here in the UK doing the G20 summit, where, if you might remember, he described it as saving the world. But in a way he did, because he saved the global financial system. We had, in 2008, we'd invested in a product to help people make sense of regulatory change. And those two effects, quantitative easing, Gordon Brown saving the world, and then specifically here in the UK, by the early spring of 2009, it absolutely looked like there was going to be a change of government. And those three factors catapulted the business. 3 years later, our business was four times larger than it had been in the autumn of 2008. So it was a real one of those moments that I think a lot of business people will understand. You've just got to grit your teeth, get on with it, and get a bit of luck along the way too.
Yeah. And you steadily rose through the PR Week rankings, and obviously kind of there was a bit of luck that came your way. But I mean, what sort of strategies were you employing to ensure that you could capitalize on the opportunities that came to you?
So in order to grow the business beyond where we'd been, we had to invest, right? So that was investing in new sectors and opportunities. Having become number one in financial services, we said, well, can we replicate that anywhere else? Now, again, for any independent business, the access to capital is always the restraint. And, you know, in reality, to be able to do something very, very meaningful probably meant having more capital and working out a way to do that. But we did what we could, and we built specifically out into other highly regulated sectors. So we started to develop in health and pharma. We started to develop in infrastructure. The the link to the investment community and the city was probably easier in things like infrastructure. Our Brussels business, certainly before the referendum, the Brexit referendum, you know, was growing significantly. So it was really trying to take the attributes that we'd built, I hope successfully, around a particular market sector and try and apply those to other parts of the pie. Of course, the other thing we did was to go and buy a business.
Yes.
We bought a business in order just to give us both greater scale, but also a significant touch across other parts of the economy, tech and infrastructure in particular. So we bought a business called Westbourne about 2 or 3 years before we then took the business into Havas.
And what were the sort of key learning? I mean, there's a lot of entrepreneurs, have particularly a lot of agency entrepreneurs that have a desire to do M&A. I mean, what were your sort of learnings from buying Westbourne and bringing it into Cicero?
So, you know, before we even bought Westbourne, what was really important was to do a sort of business MOT. Kick the tires really, really hard on whether or not we had the right strategy. You need advice. It's all going on in your head. You can, after a while, start doing things that become hobbies that don't really make any money. We had a little bit of that going on. So, you know, the first thing for us was to just get match fit. Certainly get match fit before you acquired a business. And then I think when you kind of got good fundamentals in place, you're ready to acquire that business.
Interesting.
And then, you know, hopefully that creates the catapult effect.
And that's making sure you're ready to acquire. So not just having necessarily the opportunity to or the desire to, you've got to be in a place yourself before you should embark on that kind of strategy.
Yes, because, you know, you are... you're doing something that is a bit of a leap of faith. You're going significantly faster than you'd perhaps intended 2 or 3 years earlier. There is suddenly risk again. You know, you can be very comfortable with the model that you've got, and buying something inevitably changes, you could say disrupts that model, both in terms of the economics and the people. So you're almost going back to the mindset that you had at the very start when you launch a business, I think, which is you're creating a bit of risk again in your life.
No, definitely. And you mentioned you acquired it in part because of scale. I'm Westbourne actually came with a lot of new sectors for you. So I'd argue that that was a big part of the success of it, was Because scale isn't always the right reason to make an acquisition. But the sectors, I think, given you were a financial services specialist, and then to add in, as you said, infrastructure and I think energy and so forth in there, I think that served you very well to kick you on to expand those markets out for you.
Yeah, look, without doubt. And I think the thing that's also really important is you keep learning.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we were taking on board sectors, issues, mm-hmm. that had not been part of our bag before,
yeah,
not been part of our brief. And I do think, particularly running a consultancy business, you need that fresh intensity.
Yeah,
you need that reinvention to be at the top of your game.
Yeah,
you know, because I think in any walk of life, you can get terribly comfortable in your lane, doing the same thing, driving the same journey each day, and you need to kick on, and I think an acquisition was part of that.
And did you find it had a halo effect amongst both within the business but also externally, or was it sort of fairly muted?
No, it had a huge effect for us. It had a huge impact internally. There was lots to do. There was lots to think about. There were new avenues, opportunities to go after that wouldn't have presented themselves before. But also the market kind of went pop.
Yeah.
The market was really quite interested.
Really.
More people started writing about us. I mean, actually, when we did our deal, I eschewed the idea of a traditional handshake, and I gave the founder of Westbourne a massive bear hug, and all the papers rather loved that. But I mean, there was purpose in that, Joe. There was purpose in that. The purpose was, I want to try and capture the imagination of where we go next, both for our own people, but also for the market.
Yeah. As sort of a physical manifestation of embracing the business and bringing that business close into yours, which is going to be an important part of it being successful, right? Of getting very close together. But you talk about needing to keep evolving and the business to keep coming outside of your swim lane in order to keep things fresh. And then in February 2020, you sold your business to Havas. After so many years as an independent and with Cicero in the best place it had ever been, what made you decide to sell?
Really simply, we had shareholders.
Okay.
We made a promise to those angel investors right at the start, and we were those angel investors too, right? That they would get a return. Mm. And, they'd been very patient along the way. And some we'd bought out along the way. We needed a opportunity. And just as we created an opportunity for ourselves when we bought Westbourne, we created a new opportunity for ourselves when we sold to Havas. Just to give everybody a sense of where we were, it was the 28th of February 2020 that we sold to Havas, 3 weeks before lockdown. Yep. I mean, in all reality, both ourselves and Havas probably had wanted to complete at the end of 2019. So I really did sit there doing this as we got into 2020 and COVID started to have its impact on the market. But no, it was about the economic opportunity, yes, but it was also about the wider opportunity for the business.
So okay.
Just as we catapulted when we bought Westbourne, we then catapulted when we joined Havas. And what do I mean by that? We were able to do more global work. We were able to do more big ticket stuff that, frankly, however brilliant you are as an independent, you just can't get through the procurement machine. You can't tick every single box when you're independent. It's hugely frustrating. You might have the best team around, but you don't have an awful lot of the infrastructure that Big Co, Global Co wants to see. So that's been hugely powerful for us. And look, the proof of the pudding, has been this, that, okay, 2020 was a difficult year for every yes. business. But in 2021, about half of our new business activity was coming to us from being a part of Havas.
Wow.
And by 2022, two-thirds of our new business activity was coming to us from being a part of Havas. Why? Because part of the concept of being part of this amazing global group is that you take your business
yep.
and you locate it in something called one of the Havas villages. And we did that here, and we did that in Brussels. Mm. What does that mean? Rather than having to email people around
yep.
or try and connect, mm-hmm. you actually physically connect. So I'm constantly bumping in
yep.
to other Havas businesses yep. in the London village. There's another 40 businesses that are owned or part owned
yep.
by the group, and therefore you just collaborate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting because there's definitely a perception in the market that certainly the global holding groups aren't good at sharing on the inside. Like, you kind of can be sold this opportunity, but you know, it's not always easy to realize. And it sounds like that co-location is quite an important part of it. Is there other things that within Havas in terms of their philosophy that you think has encouraged that beyond just co-location?
I think it's three things. The villages.
Yep.
Secondly, ensuring that in their acquisition strategy, there's not a lot of overlap.
Yeah.
Right. You do see in some of these other groups
yep.
that they buy lots and lots
yep.
and lots of the same stuff and stack it up. And when competitive opportunities kind of come together,
yep.
Everyone's fighting like cats in a bag in some of these other groups in order to win the business.
Yeah.
Havas don't do that. They buy very complementary businesses.
Yeah.
So you can work together, you can combine together
mm-hmm.
Because everyone's got a different discipline set. Mm. And the third principle is it's genuinely very devolved.
Okay.
As long as you meet the financial targets, we have a considerable amount of freedom and our brand to go and achieve what we want to go
yeah.
and achieve. They've invested in you.
Yeah.
They've invested in your approach
mm.
and your strategy. And you see this. You know, there are many businesses mm-hmm. that Havas have bought over the years that still have their brand name
yes.
firmly attached to them.
Yeah.
So, no, look, until you sell,
yeah.
you never know. But our journey so far,
yeah.
you know, with those three ingredients, those three principles, has been working really well.
Great. I know that's so good to hear because it's not the experience of all. So I'm so pleased for you. If I may, I'm going to take a little segue and start talking about a slightly different part of your life. And you've become a constant presence in the UK political media. What was the inflection point or the moment that got you into this?
So I've always been interested in news.
Yeah.
As I said up front, you know, that movie inspired everything.
Yeah.
Anybody that knows me, Joe, I'm not a bystander-y kind of person. I kind of rather get involved. Frankly, being out and about,
mm-hmm.
Doing interviews, talking to the press, for me does two or three things.
Yeah.
Firstly, it's about always being on top of your game,
yep.
knowing what the agenda
yep.
is, seeing with a very wide lens
mm-hmm.
what's taking place. Secondly, it's actually about the craft of the day job too.
Mm.
I mean, I do believe that, okay, there is a bit of marketing in this.
Yes.
You know, that I can sit in front of a client and say, I know what it's like to be... Mm-hmm. With the Today
yep.
program microphone in front of me, or
yep.
the Question Time microphone
yep.
in front of me, or the Sky News
yep.
microphone in front of me. And sometimes that's really tough.
Yep.
Sometimes that goes well, sometimes it doesn't go as well. But I think, and not a lot of people do this in comms, you know, the there's a view from some which is the comms guy or girl should not be the person in front
yep.
of the microphone. That's a perfectly legitimate view. I take a different view.
Yep.
And you know, the third part of it is, you know, when I am out there, I am talking about things, hopefully, that I genuinely believe in. I mean, you know, I really do believe we've got to up the growth and investment rate here in the UK, and business can play a really important part in delivering that investment. And why do I say that? Because I sit and work with global investors every day. So hopefully I'm giving a bit of an echo to the things that they're interested in. I do passionately care about social mobility. I mean, my family doesn't come from this media world. My family comes from a very, very different world. So, you know, there's a little bit of me, I suppose, that feels it sort of broke a ceiling and is constantly motivated by this. Look, I am restless and I'm curious. That's my problem.
And have you, or is this something that you've always wanted to do, or is it something that, that you kind of have evolved into? Because sitting in front of a microphone would put the, you know, the fear into many, many people. But obviously you've developed some comfort in front of it, albeit maybe there's nerves underneath.
Oh, there's huge nerves underneath. I mean, the first time I did Question Time, I think it was in Hampshire, and there's a journey from Waterloo Station in London to I think it was Winchester we were in. Yes, Winchester we were in. And I went to the loo 7 times in the space of 90 minutes.
Wow.
And yeah, your adrenaline is going. Actually, in life, if your adrenaline is not going a little bit, not uncontrollably,
sure,
but if it's not going a little bit, you're not on your game, I believe. No. You're not, you don't care.
Yeah.
I care about probably too much, but I am really quite passionate about certain things. But no, I mean, you sit in that Question Time studio. I wrote about this in a book I did just before lockdown. And your brain is computing so many things. It's computing the question that's asked. It's computing how to interact with the other panelists.
Yeah.
It's computing the 100 people that are sat in front of you. What it's not computing, and it must never compute, and I do think this is where people get frozen by the microphone, is the 4 million people that are sitting watching Question Time at home or on the iPlayer. Mm. Yeah. I think if you do that, you'd completely lose it. So for me, the trick of that kind of thing is it's quite an interesting dinner party.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you can get that mindset, have an interesting joust, say the things that you want to say, prepare.
Yeah.
Prepare. Don't just walk in and think you can put it all together. Very, very, very few people that can do that. But actually, the people that do it brilliantly have always prepared everything that they want to say.
Right. So you've got all your notes in front of you. Are you aware of the questions that might come your way, or are you given a feel for it, or is it just the where it is in the geography of the country that it may impact the questions
so for,
to get?
For Question Time, you genuinely do not know the questions that are going to be asked by the audience. However, for anybody who's watched the show, you know, it is the 4 or 5 key topics of the week.
Yeah.
So you've got a reasonable idea of the kind of issues that are going to come up.
Right. And I've watched it and I've watched you on it. You're very impressive. But it is a bit of a bear pit of a show, and politics is incredibly partisan at the moment.
Yeah.
How does it feel when you're walking off set? Well, what's going through your mind, and what's your routine once you've finished it?
Well, people usually head straight for alcohol.
Right.
they go straight for alcohol. It's usually quite an effective tool to calm you down. As I did last night, unfortunately it was on time, but with my accent, I've done the show a couple of times in Scotland, and you head straight for the sleeper and the club car and a wee dram. You know, tends to do what you need to. There was one time I did the show in Glasgow, and the room was so cold. It was so cold, Joe, that at the end of the programme and the credits rolled and the director said, "We're out," everybody from the panel ran straight to the loo, basically, because you've got, as I say, that high intensity adrenaline that's been going on. It was freezing. But alcohol is quite a good way after the show to cope with these experiences.
I think you'll have deserved it. So I want to change tack again, if we may. There's so many facets to your life. So I'd like to talk about the political side of what you've done and what you do. Obviously, being, you know, as you said, 16 was a real moment of inflection and watching all the president's men. And you joined the Conservative Party. How old were you and why?
Yeah, so about that time, I was 16. I believed in a party that was pro-business, mm-hmm. that wanted to see change. I think actually, in those days, given its leadership, a party that was interested in social mobility, genuinely interested in social mobility. And my first ever party conference was in 1984. It was the conference where the bomb went off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And no political conference since has been the same. The sort of wrap of Fort Knox-like security that goes round a political conference. And I lost a friend that was in the hotel that night. A few weeks later, she succumbed to her injuries. So. You know, being a member of a political party, becoming active, it's not just about the policies. It's also about friendships. I'm not a tribal person. I am absolutely not a tribe. But you kind of join a tribe you do something like that. But I stuck with it, and I probably actually got even more bound up in it again when Cameron became prime minister. I like the politics of Cameron. I quite like the coalition. Yeah. I quite like the fact that more socially liberal possibilities were there alongside some good economic fundamentals. I think that a lot of people out there that think that strong economic fundamentals, fiscal credibility, and social progress don't need to be in conflict. And I think that's what's all got rather mashed up lately. But because of that, after almost 40 years, last year I kind of ripped up my Conservative Party membership card.
We'll come to that. But, you know, you talked about friendship, you talked about joining a tribe. You must know a lot of the current crop of Tory politicians quite well.
Yeah.
What's it been like watching their rise and in some cases their fall?
Well, it's kind of, it's strange. I think many of us who are fortunate enough to be around kind of business or public life in some way, you know, you see people that are friends, they're your cohort, they're your age, like you, they're trying to break through in politics, and then you suddenly see them grow to be around the cabinet table, and you're kind of rather pinching yourself to say, "Well, actually, I kind of know some of these people." I think what you do get at that level is you do get a sense of how difficult choices in public life are, how the art of compromise and consensus. And in the sense of being a minister in a government where there is something called collective responsibility means that you have to trim and hedge and maybe just not say what you actually believe. And I have lots of friends in politics who, in professional politics, who have become ministers, who I absolutely know, because when you sit down and have dinner or a drink, they say, "Oh, it's a nightmare." But that problem seems to have got worse and worse and worse. And I sometimes kind of think, well, you know, why do you do it in business? I think you have much more of an opportunity to be and do and walk out in the way that is more definitively, authentically, as people use the expression these days, you.
Yeah.
I think lots of my friends in politics have had to trim and hedge
interesting
who they really are in so many ways. Mm. And it's quite hard to watch that.
Yeah, I bet it is. But in September 2021, you were asked yourself to become closer to the government, and you were the LGBT business champion. How did that come about?
So I had always at work been a champion for mobility, equality, and being part of the LGBT community, specifically LGBTQ rights. And I was approached by the Johnson government to say, well, would you have a look at being someone that could drive forward some of these workplace rights? I thought, well, you know, when you get a call like that, you might never get an opportunity like that to do something. I thought, well, you know, there is an opportunity. What was I happy with all that the Johnson government was or was not doing in terms of its commitments to equality? No. But I thought, well, actually, this is maybe an opportunity to go
to be on the inside,
the tent, and try and create change. I was wrong.
What was it like being in number 10 under Boris Johnson's government?
If you've watched an episode of The Thick of It, it's not far away from the truth. In fact, the part of government that I was attached to was the Government Equalities Office. It even looks, if you, again, any of you have watched that, there's lots of glass and chrome and people going in and out of glass and chrome offices. It looks like the set of The Thick of It, let alone the activities of The Thick of It. No, I mean, for about half that brief time I was doing that job, I think there was a commitment. Yeah. I think then some of the personalities changed in the Kingly Court that was the Johnson government that we all know, the world can now see. And they did a screeching U-turn on those commitments. And I spent about 2 or 3 months being actually quite rightly accosted by people saying, well, hang on, there's nothing going on here. What are you going to do about it? And the final straw was when they did a, not just a U-turn, it felt like a bloody, you know, backflip on the issue of conversion therapy. For me, that is, as a gay person, that is a abhorrent practice. Sure. It's trying to convince people that they're not gay. Mm. The Conservatives had promised that piece of legislation since Theresa May had been in power in 2018. And, well, we're talking to each other in the spring of 2024, and they still haven't passed that legislation. Mm. It's quackery. In a modern society, I would argue it's actually evil.
Yeah.
The government wouldn't do it, and up with it, I wouldn't put, so I walked out.
Yeah, fair enough. But let's bring ourselves right up to date. And I would say this is will be our final, but one of a significant inflection point for you is leaving the Conservatives getting much closer to Labour and aligning yourself there. How did you make the change? Why did you make the change?
Probably the most significant inflection point in that sense was the budget of September 2022. Mm. And I took a call in the day job at Cicero from the team in Downing Street called the Business Relations Team. They basically organized the conversation between business and government. And if we all remember that time, the city screens were a sea of red. Mm. People who had never heard of the yield curve suddenly found it on their 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock news, the front page of their newspapers. And the business team said to me, so what did you think of the budget last Friday? And I said, it's a disaster.
Wow.
And they said, well, but there's some good parts of the budget. And I said, yeah, but nobody can see them. Nobody can hear them because you've blown up what I thought the Conservative Party was about, and that was fiscal coherence, economic credibility. And worse than that, you've added thousands of pounds of cost to the average mortgage holder and probably tens, hundreds, millions in terms of costs to many businesses. And if we're not the party for homeowners and businesses, what's the point? And a few weeks later, I went to America. And it was right about the time of the US midterms. I always do that. I always try and spend time in America right about the time of an election. And I wanted to talk to them about what was happening in American politics. They weren't interested in talking to me about that at all. Yeah. They basically said, what on earth is going on in Britain? And I sat on the plane on the way back and I genuinely couldn't answer the question anymore. And a few weeks later, I went to see Keir Starmer's team and I told them what I've told you. And I said, well, I mean, this is a major opportunity for Labour, not always the party of business in any way, shape or form. The Conservatives have blown up their mantra of fiscal coherence. You have an opportunity to step into that role. 2 weeks later, I get a call from Keir's team saying, how does Keir get to Davos? And I send them the way to do that. Like, well, you really are serious. Davos is not a natural home and territory for the leader of a left of centre party. No. But he knew that you're only going to get growth. You're only going to create economic opportunity. You're only going to create the highest level of growth in the G7, which is Labour's first planned mission if it's to win the election, by getting businesses confident in your strategy.
Yeah.
And that's in the first few weeks of 2023. And then I got sight of the plans for the Conservatives' election strategy, which seems to me to be to pit parts of our society against each other. And I've always been a One Nation Conservative, and that was it. I thought there's nothing One Nation about this. This is about running a culture war, stoking division. Oh, by the way, and you've also lost economic credibility too. So I ripped up my Conservative Party membership card, and in the way that a country and a healthy democracy, I think after a decade of a government being in power, probably needs change. This country now needs change.
Right.
And I'm more convinced about that than ever. And it's kind of why I've written that report for Keir Starmer's team on how to create a really strong link between business and government again.
I feel a bit like we're on question time here. This has been great. and you know, my final question that I ask all of my guests is, you know, we've looked back and thank you so much for that. Just looking forward, and what is it that you're looking forward to over the next 12 months? And, you know, I know this business review has been a big part of your life up until very, very recently. Perhaps you can tell us a bit about that.
Well, look, I'm really optimistic. In a year where about 50% of global GDP is going to the polls, someone like me that geeks out on politics is bound to be optimistic. There's going to be a lot of change ahead. In the day job running Cicero, that always gets me excited. So therefore, there's lots of opportunities, I think, that are coming businesses way. And I would say, you know, just go with those opportunities.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's the first thing. I think that, I mean, I'm very hopeful that we are going to see a change of government here. And I think that will create freshness. I think that it will create new dynamism in terms of the way in which the country operates. So, and we haven't even talked about where we're going with tech, where we're going with the AI challenges, where, you know, this job just gets more and more interesting. But That's fine by me.
Ian, thank you so much for spending time with us. It's so great to hear your story.
Thank you.
Inflection Points is a production of SI Partners, the M&A advisor and growth consultancy to creative and technology businesses. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Joe Hine, and you've been listening to Inflection Points.